Welcome to Life After Business, the podcast that helps you understand what your company is worth and what your exit options are. Host Ryan Tansom and his guests give you all the information you need to get clarity and control over your business, build a valuable company to be proud of, and exit on your terms.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Life After Business podcast. This is episode 156, and today's episode is very special for a couple different reasons. The first one is that Jack Stack is on my show, and I am a humongous fan. I love him, everything he does, and I'm just absolutely honored to have him on the show. And the second thing is I have a huge announcement to make from my career standpoint with my business. Over the last few years, we've been delivering growth and exit planning services through GEXP Collaborative, and if you're one of my avid fans and listeners, you've heard me talk about it a lot. We've been delivering these services and building out this model so that way the owners can get all of the things that I wish I would have had before we sold the company. But being able to get it on a scalable model has been so difficult. And when we look at the sheer quantity of millions of companies that are going to go into market, people need help. And so over the last 6 months, I've done some major reflecting of how we can actually take this to the next level. And what it came to the conclusion is that I have split off from GEXP Collaborative and created our Kona, so that way we can then take our Kona so we can scale this to help as many owners as possible. We have built out over the last 6 months a 3-day mergers and acquisitions growth and exit bootcamp for owners. That is 3 days on jam-packed full of material to level the merger and acquisition playing field and to deliver this on a scalable model. If you go and you'll see the agenda on the website, and we're doing them in Minnesota on October 8th, 9th, and 10th. And there also is going to be a class in Dayton, Ohio on November 11th, 12th, and 13th. All the registration forms are on the Arcona website. So this is just one little thing with tons and tons of stuff to come as we continue to launch and absolutely hit the throttle button behind this. So after I'm done rambling, you're probably wondering who the heck is the guest, Ryan, and what's the point? Well, today on my show, we have Jack Stack, who is the founder of SRC Holdings and is a god in open book management. He is the author of The Great Game of Business and A Stake in the Outcome. Aside from the books, Jack is a contributor to the New York Times and Inc. magazine. He has been a judge at Ernst & Young's Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Fortune magazine called him one of the top 10 minds in small businesses. And SRC Holdings has been nominated as the top 100 companies to work for in America. Pretty much Jack's a badass, and he's amazing, and what he does is so awesome that this episode is literally one of my favorites. His unique approach to leadership, operating a business, and his KPIs has taken his companies to the next level. And a lot of people think of it as unconventional because of how transparent and how he runs his companies. Jack took SRC Holdings from a $9 million debt and $100,000 down payment with an 89-to-1 debt to equity ratio and 10 cents a share up to $600 a share, doing over $400 million in revenue. And he took people on the shop floor making 15 bucks an hour now that are literally multimillionaires because of his ownership thinking. He ended up doing an ESOP with his company, and then they have just absolutely exploded through his open book management, the Great Game of Business operating system, and how he uses transparency and leadership to get everybody rowing in the same direction, playing the same game, and absolutely destroying the competition and changing people's lives. This was literally one of my favorite episodes, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, because it was an honor to interview Jack Stack.
Sponsored by Arcona's Growth and Exit Bootcamps. 3 days jam-packed with material on the 5 growth and exit principles and the world of mergers and acquisitions. You'll walk away knowing exactly what steps to take to get your target valuation and your best exit option. 3 days at Arcona's Bootcamp will give you the clarity to control the rest of the journey.
Good morning, Jack. How are you?
I'm doing great, Ryan. How are you?
Doing good. I'm super excited to have you on the show. As I was saying, Bo Burlingham is a hero of mine when I read his book, which all my audience knows, after we sold the business. And obviously then kept going with his books and read yours. And kind of one of those things where, like, holy shit, I wish I would have read all of these when we had the business, because it would have been able to be a little bit more applicable. And, you know, I actually mentioned your book in my keynote. And one of my friends went and she did The Great Game of Business after hearing it. So he's pretty excited to listen to this show too. But You know, so Jack, I'm just, you know, maybe just give us the quick brush strokes of SRC Holdings, like how, like the kind of the origination story, because I know it started with $100,000 and, you know, you and some partners, like how did it start? And then kind of how did it end up into the ESOP that you guys ended up doing?
Well, I'll make it kind of quick. I mean, we basically did a hard time. And what I mean is that it's not prison time. We were byproducts of the Industrial Revolution and the old command and control era, the era of where loyalty, security, family life quality was predominant but difficult to be able to achieve. So I worked for a Fortune 500 company for 14 years and really believed in those kind of things, believed in security, believed in getting home at 4 or 5 o'clock at night, you know. But then I was there when it collapsed. I was there when we transferred from the industrial age to the information age, and that happened around the 80s, and it was pretty devastating. It was a huge layoff in our country, and unemployment was at 12%, real time, 12%. So when you were trying to survive, it was very difficult because if you downsized the company and you laid people off, you know, it was very difficult for them to find a job at a 12% market. And we were at this time now, after 14 years, we were assigned a small factory in Springfield, Missouri. And it was on its knees in 78, 79. And by the time we had gotten down here by 80 to 82, we just turned it around. We just ripped and roared. And we just had a really, really good time. We were so far away from the corporate office. We were entrepreneurial. The community, most of the people were farmers that came off the farm and went to work and said simple things like, give me the tools to do the job and get the hell out of my way. You know?
Yeah.
Man, that's like nirvana. It's for a lazy manager, it's like nirvana.
You know? Right.
You know, I came from an industrial union, 4,000 employees under one factory. I mean, you know how difficult that was? Okay. And now someone sits there and goes, feed me, you know? So yeah. We gave them everything. We gave them tools. We gave them knowledge. We gave them pride, and we ran a really good show and took out everybody. There were 17 manufacturing facilities inside of International at that time, and we took almost down every one of them on every metric you could have. And so we really came to the conclusion that people love to win. You know, they just love to win, and it's almost the only thing you kind of unify behind, other than you hate to lose, you know. But so what happens, we now crash, and the company says, look, you're not part of the core competencies. And every time they say that, it's like hearing a flush, toilet flush, right? So, you know, when you get into the diversified division, nobody lasts more than a year in the diversified. So I went to the people and I said, look, you know, we got transferred. This doesn't look really good. Do you want to make an attempt at buying the place? And I only asked them to buy the place. And it's roughly, it was about 300 people at that time. I asked if they wanted to buy the place because I was going to feel so guilty that I'd have to lay somebody off, and I couldn't lay somebody off if I didn't try not to lay them off, okay? So I went to them and I said, do you want to buy the place, in the hopes that they would say, are you crazy? Are you stupid? I don't want to follow you. And they were so afraid, okay? I didn't follow anybody, anybody that had an idea, because you know, we laid off in the corporate 1,000 people a week for 2 years. Okay, that's how many. So every newspaper article, every movie show, you know, showed the demise of International Harvester and from 1980 to 1983. So the people, I ended up saying, oh God, okay. So we made a run at buying the place, and it was all story, all to its own. We knew how to make tractors, we knew how to make engines, but we did not know how to make a company. We were never trained in 14 years to build a company, okay? I mean, we had to build the best TD-25C construction equipment and get it on that rail car. And that was the extent of what our responsibilities were. We would lead the hundreds and hundreds of people, but, you know, never giving you financial information.
HR, all that stuff.
Oh, man, that's exactly right. You know, and most of it is, you know, I was a superintendent of 500 people, and you're just trying to survive, okay? I mean, it's not... You're not going to worry about what your margins are and your tractors. I had to get the engines and the tractors to the customer. And then you go into buying and I had a lot of good metrics, okay? I mean, really strong metrics in manufacturing. It was really strong metrics, and I really appreciate the metrics, but they're all centered at making a product, okay? The metrics were not at the company. So when I went out to try to borrow an unrated sum of money, which is advice I'd give anybody instead of going to get an MBA. Okay, I mean, you want an MBA real quick, go to 20 financial institutions with a lousy business plan. Okay.
Right.
And ask for an outrageous amount of money. You'll learn business real quick. So when I went to knock on the first banker, I looked really good. I had wingtips on that time, you know, and I had a fake laptop computer, and I thought, you know, image was everything, and I showed them how I built a tractor and could care less. So they go, man, you know, we got a different language up here. Okay. We do have different metrics. You know, we want to see your collateral. We want to see your receivables. We want to see your inventory terms. You know, we want to, you know, and I'm sitting there like, are you kidding me? I never heard of anything like this in my entire life. And,
just give me the money.
Yeah, I thought I was loyal. I look at it, I'm saving 300 jobs. Guys, this is like morality. You know, it's like, why wouldn't you lend money when we're trying to do the same jobs? You know, going back to our church religious days, you know, we're going to save the world. So we then had to learn bankese. I call it bankese. We had to learn how investment communities, you know, people look at a business, how they evaluate a business. And a lot of times the product has nothing to do or the service has nothing to do with it, okay, when it comes to the banks, okay, or when it comes to the people that have money. But after about 10 or 15 trips to the banks, okay, I mean, it became a routine. And I worked at night with these 14-column green long sheet papers, right? I mean, I really worked out trying to figure out the cash flow statement. and then let me tell you one thing. In 14 tries, I never got it right, okay? But I always took cash flow and put it in the last month, right? Whenever I was short, I just plugged the last year. But then I would go through the process, and I could figure out, well, why didn't anybody teach me this earlier? Because,
oh my gosh, so true.
It doesn't change. Okay. I mean, it doesn't change, you know, when the monks put this together in the 1400s, all right, but it hasn't changed since the 1400s. All right. And then I got angry. Okay. I got angry from the standpoint of, wow, in 14 years, they never asked me to create an outrageously successful company. They never talked to me in these metrics. They only talked to me in the metrics of a tractor. What would have happened if they would have just said, look, this is the metrics of a sustainable, successful business, you know, that will be able to provide the values of security, the values of healthcare, the values of loyalty, the values of, you know, security, you know. And they even got more irate because in manufacturing, you're talking about, you learn productivity, and productivity is about taking steps out of the process.
Mm-hmm.
And my point was that if everybody wanted to have an outrageously successful company, why weren't we quantifying that with our people? Why were we telling them that they had to put 300 turbos on the assembly lines, on units, 8 hours a day, and repetitive accountabilities? Okay. Accountabilities that only had relationship to the product. Didn't have any relationship to the financials of the company, okay?
Oh, my gosh.
So we made a promise on our 15th to 20th visit to the financial gurus. We made a promise to ourselves saying, this is crazy. If we want to have this kind of company, and this is the metrics that we're thinking we can do, why would we ask everybody to do that, you know? I had really good engine builders and I had really good tractor builders, right? You know, but I didn't really have good business people, you know. But yet at the same token, I was supposed to get these metrics in business. So through a whole comedy of mistakes, okay, and over maybe almost 50 visitations on raising capital, we found a bank that was in serious trouble. And when you're in serious trouble, you got to book bad loans. And we finally realized we are the best ones for this bank.
And we're the best loan out there.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're really going to increase your net interest margins, you got to take on a lot of risk. You know, there's really nothing more riskier than what
these tractor boys some money.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. And so we just went up to Oak Brook, Illinois and said, I hear you're booking bad loans. I got a doozy for you, right? So it was in the midst of a collapse of the biggest bank in America. They fired their chairman out in California. They fired their New York president. They were closing down their asset-based lenders. And we ended up, because of all these things coming together, to book the worst loan in corporate America. Okay, we ended up borrowing $9 million and only had $100,000 worth of equity. Right. Which is a miracle. And today's terms, you know, it's like 89-1 debt to equity. Yeah. I mean, they don't even do 4-1. They don't even do 4-1 today, you know.
They can imagine possible.
You can only imagine there was divine intervention. Okay, that's the only explanation for someone doing this.
For $100,000.
So then that was the start. I mean, the start was we were heavily in debt, 89-1. We had an interest rate of 14%. Our first year, we owed $1.2 million in interest expense alone, right? But we had saved, we began to save hundreds and hundreds of jobs, okay? We, Harvester quickly fired us, and then we had to hire ourselves back, which is interesting. But we began by showing people the metrics of business, the finances of business, how to measure a healthy company. And it's really kind of simple because you are told in a simple accounting course that you measure the health of a company by understanding the health of the balance sheet. That's a fact. That's reality. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you what your temperature is. And instead of being 98.7, if it's 101.1, you know you've got a fever and you got to do something about it, right? So it was amazing at first because it was very difficult for our people to really understand it. And the reason that they didn't understand it is because nobody taught them.
Yeah.
More importantly, nobody really wanted to relinquish that kind of information to be able to teach the people. So therefore, the people were intimidated from the standpoint that they must be stupid and they're not allowed to see it. So therefore, let's not ask any questions about it. Now, the bad thing is that they're coming to work every single day, buying houses, and buying cars, and putting kids through college, and they don't have any idea whether the company is liquid or not, right? Our philosophy was, man, you can't get any more transparent to say we dug about the deepest hole you could ever imagine.
Please help us. You know.
Yeah, so please don't ask me whether you should buy a car or whether you should have a kid. I'll just tell you, no, right now you probably shouldn't, you know. But if you take the balance sheet from 89-1 to 4-1, you know, man, you've really got something here. And then if, in fact, you had a piece of that pie, you know, you wouldn't believe how this game is played when all of a sudden you take a tremendous amount of debt and you convert it into equity.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't even believe it. You still, 20 years later, you won't believe it because you're not going to believe that $1 worth of profit can be equivalent to anywhere between 5 and 20 times that amount.
Yeah.
That's going to be a very difficult. But all along the way, we'll try to teach you and tell you exactly where we stand. So we began to speak in bankies, they call it. I don't know what else to call it, right? And we communicated. We taught people business. And what happened was is that when you teach people the fundamentals of business, man, they create their own businesses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what's happened is that, I mean, we've just had a 36-year run that has just been a miracle. You know, and we've had a ball doing it through all different types of hailstorms and hurricanes and tornadoes and everything of this nature. But when you get people to really understand business, it's just, it's productivity. It's what the world needs. It's what the United States needs, you know, because I think what's happening with the system that we have right now is that, you know, there's an argument about the 1% versus the 99%. And it's always used as an argument. Never do we ask the question, would the 99th like to be one of the ones, you know? And so we go out there and try to tell our people, don't bitch about the 1%, okay? We'll show you how the 1% got to be 1%.
Yeah, let's do it. Well, yeah. It's so crazy, Jack. I was re-listening to your book before the show. And there's so much that I want to unpack here. But, you know, one of the things that there's a very, you know, parallel stories because I got slammed into our family business and we were factoring. So, I mean, for all intents and purposes, it was very similar to yours. So we had zero line of credit for a $20 million business and 100 people in payroll. So like, it was literally like you had said, like, you just have no choice to get everybody on the same page to help you. And the thing that I find it interesting to kind of tie this all together is that, you know, I was never a very good student either. And then, like, you know, I was never a finance guy, but then you become, like, you learn it. And I think it's so interesting because all of this ties really back down to education. And no one ever was able to answer the why question for me. I'm a guy that asks why all the time.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And then people just be like, because, and I'm like, you want to piss me off is just say because without any context. And then what happened was, is when I got into the, you know, the troubled business, I found out what the because was. And then you learn the balance sheet and the cash flow statements and the P&L, and you're just going, okay, I now know what game I'm playing and I now understand. And then everything trickles down from there. And it's just, it's very amazing that people don't get taught this stuff. And it's just crazy because I watch how much fun people have. But to tie it back to what you were saying in an American, all this is that I see a huge problem with that, where like there's just not anybody teaching this stuff. And you know, the 1% like you're talking about, I don't know if you're familiar with Ray Dalio. So Ray,
yeah, really. Yeah, I am. Yeah.
He wrote this amazing article talking about, really, it's a lot of the stuff that you talk about in your book, and like just educating people on this so that way they can participate. And conscious capitalism is talking about it these days. And I think that there's a shift in your book, literally, and what the great game of business is a way to like actually bridge that gap. I don't know how else you can do it.
It is bridgeable. I mean, we have people on the shop floor making $15, $16, $18 an hour that have over $1.5 million worth of equity.
That's so cool.
All right, let's put it another way. We have people on the shop floor that are the 1%.
There's no other way you can do that.
No, now there isn't. And get it. It is just absolutely, your world opens up and it's a tremendously different way of looking at things.
I had,
you're now bringing back the dream, man. You're bringing back the dream. I mean, there is really a dream out there. There is a dream out there.
Well, and I interviewed this gentleman named Daniel Goldstein, who he's now running this company down in Cedar Rapids. They've been around for 134 years, and they're an ESOP. And he said, like, literally, it's the purest form of capitalism because you can directly invest your labor and your work. Like, you can't do that anywhere else.
But you also keep your own working capital, and the government doesn't get it until the associate leaves the company. So your private ownership is more responsible on capital than public ownership is. It's your capital.
And when you get to keep it. And so, look, Jack, you know, for the listeners, let's. Can you explain, you know, because we're obviously talking some about the ESOP, but explain, it makes sense to me now how you ended up kind of leaning towards that, the ESOP, but you know, what were the challenges? Because I think, you know, the challenges of going for where the owner is today. And I think it even starts with the owner so based on what I do for my job now, Jack, is that the most owners don't even know this stuff. Like, they're juggling cash flow all the way to the end instead of actually, you know, doing the stuff that you're talking about. So how did you, you know, not only what was the context of the ESOP, and then how did you get explain your like your planning process of how to actually do this? Because I think a lot of people just get paralyzed thinking, okay, I know and I understand what Jack and Ryan are talking about, but how in the heck do you do this?
That's a really good question. What we did is we went on and said, hey, you know, we're going to teach an income statement. They all ran out of the building.
Right? Banky, what? I just want to make tractor parts.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember one lady thought she was going to turn into a pillar of salt because she had worked at a previous organization, and everything that came across her desk was not for her eyes only, and, you know, confidential. And so there was this curtain that everybody thought where the axe was going to fall if they looked at a financial statement. So it was really raw. I mean, we actually had to go back and start with compounded fractions in a lot of cases because you can't do an analysis of an income statement without understanding percentages. So we even brought in the fifth grade teachers in the community to be able to provide classes and going over it. But ultimately what happened was that we decided to transfer our SAP meeting into filling out income statements. Okay. So what was the idea was, if I could go back to the Venetian monks, I would have said, when you redid this income statement, could you left the line? Can you left space for a name? Because what I found out was that everybody in that company was tied to a number in the income statement. All right, and for every, you know, whether it's material price variance, purchase price variance, whatever you want to call it, you can break down your cost of goods any way you want it. But somebody owned that line. Okay, yep. So they said, oh man, this would be an interesting way to just, instead of writing these accountabilities, you know, what if we just said your accountability is the line, right?
Right.
Kind of simple, but, you know, if you wanted a 6% reduction in your material costs, that's a purchase price variance. We got someone that's had a purchasing. Welcome to the party, okay?
Yeah. So how about that?
It was pretty, it was pretty productive. It was pretty productive by having him, instead of having the staff meeting where you're giving them anything you can find to communicate. And believe me, everybody says communicate, but we give people nothing to communicate with, right? So yeah. We thought, okay, what if they gave us the information? You know, we rolled up an income statement and a cash flow every week, and then we gave it back to them, and then we consolidated where the entire company was. All we'd be doing would be converting the stories of people into numbers, and that's all numbers really were, right?
Yeah.
So that's when we started the huddles. That's where we started the scorekeeping, which everybody finds to be really interesting, is that our huddles are putting together financial statements. The financial statement is basically what we think the expectations are going to be at the end of every month, okay? And we also have a financial planning process that they put together where they just put their own numbers in for the financial plan. They're held responsible for a year, okay? But at the same time, they're always monitored and they're given information. And, you know, but the whole idea is there's a realization that a standard is set by a marketplace and it's not set by a CEO or an HR right. department. And so we built a hunger for people to learn, okay? I mean, nobody wanted to go up in front of their peers and said, oh, man, I really screwed up on my purchasing, all right? Especially if you give them a tool to write it on the board or write it in a program. You know, it's a direct relationship. How do you like to go every week in front of your peers and say, oh, man, I got to drop this number again. I got to drop it again. I got to drop it again. So this transparency created this really, really interesting peer pressure where people began to realize that they are the ones that make the difference, okay? Mm-hmm. That if they can come together and improve that line, they could prove their psychic ownership, then the ownership of the company is going to grow. So we built in all these kind of unusual performance measurements, but they all really came down to where you stood against the financial plan that you told everybody that you could make. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a one-on-one line of sight accumulated by. Yeah, it was really kind of simple when Irene, what your receipt's going to be, Benita, what do you think the receivables are going to be? We don't realize that we got somebody doing what is going into that financial statement. So it was all about ownership. It's not only about ownership from the equity side of it. It was ownership from the job side of it. So once we got the responsibilities planned out, and then we were able to consolidate everybody, then we decided that, look, we were people that first started with nothing that said, one for all for one, we're going to make everybody owners, okay? And then we decided to make everybody owners, and then they said, oh, no, if you have over $100, you got to go public. There was all these laws, the bank said, we're not going to chase owners all over the country to pay this debt down, we're not going to. So we found ESOP as a methodology of putting more than 100 people into a equity position, and it fit real well for us. And so now the challenge was to teach people what the benefits of ESOPs were. At that time, their stock price was like 10 cents a share, which is hysterical.
Is that what it was, Meg? Is that what it was? That's what it was, because I read one of your articles where, like, was it end of last year?
Oh, yeah.
102 or something like that?
Well, no, that our comparative to the 10 cents, today it's like $600.
That's
okay, because
awesome.
We split the stock, okay. Six times. So the $100 of stock they have in their hands today is now worth $600. Wow. Pre-splits. Okay. Yeah. So I think somewhere the original $100,000 over the last 36 years has accumulated in terms of a value of almost $300 million for the associates. But what was really cool about it is that a lot of them now have retired, taking $100 million out, but they are now investing it back in the communities, buying their own businesses, excited about continually playing. They're not retiring, early. I can't tell you the number of people that have retired here and started multiple businesses because it is in their DNA. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to teach the younger generation that, you have the opportunity to have instant gratification in terms of wages. You have a healthcare program. We give you a bonus program. But on top of that, you now can get sweat equity. All right. And sweat equity is what your big leap is from getting out of the 99 and becoming the one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not wages. It's not benefits. Okay. It's not days off, short time work. Okay. Is, man, you got to capitalize on owning something.
Well, it's, I think, Jack, like, I, I still to this day, as I look at, you know, different owners, and I said in my email to you, like, you know, like there's the Inc. 5000 and 500, and then you got the Vistages and the EOs and all this stuff. And like, it's all BS until you look at the numbers. The joke that my dad and I have is we literally lost hundreds of thousands of dollars the year we were on the Inc. 5000. It's like, it's such a joke.
Okay.
Go for it. You want
a true confession? You want a true confession?
Yeah.
Okay. In the very, very early stages when it was less than the Inc. 5000. Okay. I was heavily involved in that. Okay. I went to every one of them. And I never felt so guilty when we went there and praised the fast-growing company, knowing fully well that half the audience could not make payroll on Monday.
I know. It makes no sense.
I quit going. I felt like I was truly contributing
right
to these ideas of scalability, of cocktail talk about I'm a million-dollar company. Okay, why in the world are we promoting top line growth, you know, when there's nothing below it?
Oh my gosh, Jack. I know. And it's so funny because like I was saying, in our business, so I started just total raging sales organization industry because it's copier sales. And the whole industry was comping their salespeople on top line revenue. And I remember because it's a family business, I just crushed my quota this one quarter. And I'm like, yeah. We lost money on what I did. Like, and you gave me lots of money. How does that make any sense to anybody?
You know, but that's the journey into bankees. Okay.
Yeah.
It's that the bankees really, you know, it's like going down there and you got to face the Indian that's got two roads, right? You know, it's glaring what you have to do and then how to put the puzzle together to make it fit, you know?
Yep. It's a, you know,
but let me just tell you something about your when you were telling me about you and your dad's business. Doug Tatum is a great friend of mine and wrote a tremendous book called No Man's Land. Okay. And he believes that the majority of businesses today are no similar to what you took over. Okay. That they've worked hard, they've scaled high, but the debt that they have to endure. Okay. Mm-hmm. And one penalty after another means that these entrepreneurs will never grow over a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like being in a room where all the oxygen is out of the room, right? And you're barely, you know, brushing up the ceiling to breathe. Yeah. But most of our industries are like that, okay?
I know.
When Doug writes about, he says, look, we should be focused on these entrepreneurs. They're tremendous entrepreneurs, okay? Just because they got themselves into kind of a debt situation, okay? They still grew the business. Now, let's teach them. Okay, if they do have additional capital, what they could do, you know, you're going to see a whole boom of these businesses become more secure, happier, and bring everybody along with them. That's what I believe.
Oh, I totally agree, Jack. And like, you know, it's so if you take what you were just saying to Doug, and again, all this kind of goes down to the financials and understanding the game, right? And the way when I look at these entrepreneurs, because, you know, I've been there, and, you know, it's so funny because it all ties not only to the financials and what you're talking about, but you know, like you say in your book and your stuff is that it's the value that you have of the asset. And most entrepreneurs don't think like that. So like I'll sit down in front of someone and say, okay, so you know, you got 15 million in revenue. Okay, good for you. Great. So now you're doing 1.5 in, if they know what EBITDA is, right? It's like, you know, you're doing 1.5.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, exactly. What do you mean by that? So then I'm like, well, do you know what your company's worth? And people will say probably 10 million, 15 million, zero idea, like whatsoever. And yeah. I'm like,
all right.
It's usually like if you look at your cash flow, how could your business pay for itself? What's actually worth 4 million gross. And then you're going to pay 50% in taxes and you have to pay down your debt. You literally are going to walk away with 800 grand. And people just look at you and I'm like, and by the way, these are entrepreneurs that probably have, you know, $150,000 to $300,000 lifestyles because they've been juggling cash flow and I personally believe living off the float. And they employ so many people. I'm going, how in God's name are we going to save? I mean, this is like 2/3 of American companies. I just don't. I mean, it really boils down to the financials and understanding value creation and sustainable companies. And I think that, like you said, a lot of them, they hit that ceiling and it's like, they don't know where to go because there's no rule book for this stuff.
Okay, what you just did and what you said is so right on for those businesses that are in process today, in progress, okay? Now, let me tell you where an interesting now you see it, now you don't joke is, all right, is we are convincing our kids on pre-evaluation, okay? I don't know if you ever witnessed some of the people that will be through our entrepreneur centers, our think tanks, our innovation programs, our colleges, that will then write a business plan, not have $1 for the sale, and have a pre-evaluation of it of $2 million, $3 million. Okay.
That's insane. I know.
I mean, that's like, we're getting worse. Okay. I mean, we're not getting any better. I mean, we're not teaching them reality. I mean, we are just teaching them nightmares. We're teaching them nightmares. We're teaching them nightmares.
I know. I talked to this woman, Jack, the other day, like, cause like all of the stuff that we do is people with cash flow. And I mean, because I'm in these young entrepreneurs groups and a lot of them are the pre-money valuation. I'm going, that sentence makes no freaking sense to me, but okay, continue. And they're like, well, I raised $5 million on a valuation of 20 million. I'm like, how much money are you making? She's like, well, we've never made money. And I'm like, what?
You are about to enter the Twilight Zone. Okay, this is, I want to have that recording. You ever have that recording of the Twilight Zone? You know, yeah. You got to listen to it. All right. And that when I get the pre evaluation, okay, without any sales, okay, I go, okay, even if you do make it, okay, you're gonna go into no man's land.
Yeah.
I don't understand that the second stage of pre evaluation is lack of oxygen, you know.
Oh my gosh. And, you know, I think, outside of the VC kind of total nutso stuff that like that, the big thing, Jack, is like, you know, all the stuff that I just related to so much part of your book, because I have when you have this whole like part in the book where you talk about how obsessed you got about with healthcare and we don't have to go down that rabbit hole.
Oh yeah. I'm
very similar to you where like, I kind of like, have always thought that everybody in the world just knew this stuff and never told me. But then I realized that no one is really guiding anything. And like, I'm like, okay, so if I can understand this, everybody should be able to, cause I'm not that smart. And so then like how you like actually educated the people on the numbers is just so important. And I don't know these entrepreneurs that like, they're just juggling cash and they don't know, there's no, like, and like you said, there's kind of like this stigma around numbers, right? And like, I don't know, do you think people are scared?
Yeah, right.
Or like, what's the deal? Right. Why don't people want to do this?
I have tried to understand this thing, you know, and I've read and been in front of many audiences, and I'm the same way you did. I'm the type of person that had a real tough time in school. And maybe you didn't, but I did. And I did not have a lot of confidence that I was smart at all. Okay. Yeah. I always thought I was the luckiest guy in the world. Something was going to catch up to me. Right. And so I was able to take a very complex, I think a complex problem and make it simple. Mm-hmm. And I had to do that by inventing this great game of business. Okay. I had to convince the people that business is no different than Monopoly. Business is no different than fantasy football. Business is no different than making brownies, okay? And I'll break it down into the concepts of a game, okay? I'll tell you that the game consists of rules, it consists of scorekeeping, and it consists of staking the outcome, which is winning at the game, right? And so we took the elements of a game because what we were up against was this wall of ignorance, all right? This wall we had to break down, that we had to build a confidence in the people that they could understand this stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about, you know, at our age, you know, we're just in our 30s. Okay. And what you're talking about today is people now that are in their 50s and 60s that still don't know what this is all about. Okay. So we decided that, okay, every connection would be to the, of our programs would be training them to get them to get them to understand what it was to be a business person. All right. Mm-hmm. And it would always be related to the value of the company, but it would be delegated, designated. And what we would be able to do was to show somebody what their meaning was every day, what their difference was. And we used their productivity, converted them to the numbers went into the system went back to them immediately. And we created this repetitive process, and we were able to, as a result of this repetitive process, and I believe it's repetition that changes culture and behavior.
Yep, habits.
Was to move them from this state of ignorance. Okay. I mean, they would, like, people would be hired and they go into a Wednesday meeting and hear the numbers on the board. I mean, they were totally clueless. But after about seven or eight meetings, okay, wow, I got it. You know, this comes together. And, oh yeah, I did that yesterday, and that is what really was the result of what I did yesterday. And hey, maybe this is maybe there is no such thing as a second set of books. Okay, maybe this shit works. You know,
right? Where I buy my paper clips ends up on the sheet right there. It's not just total like hocus pocus.
Yes, Khalid and Ryan, I've seen this everywhere. I've seen it in education. I've seen it in government. Okay, I've seen two maintenance guy in our local government here realized by sitting in one day trying to figure out, how can we contribute to the great game of business? And they're sitting next to a 55-gallon drum of cleaning fluid, okay, that they've been you know, cleaning things one-on-one where they could dilute it 5-to-1, okay, and ending up making $76,000 to the government, okay? Because somebody treated them, you know, captured that intellectual capacity and turned it into something productive.
I know. It's like having a universal language, and it just,
Yes.
Cause you can't, like you said, you can't play. Like it's funny because I've tried like so many different ways, Jack, to come up with analogies to explain this. I think the game is a great, I say it's like going from two-dimensional to three-dimensional. Like everything's just different once you see this. Or like even like, you know, the Matrix, when all of a sudden you see the zeros and ones everywhere and you're like, oh, like it's kind of like it's not that complicated, but everybody else is still sleeping. Doesn't make any sense.
Well, you get it. I get it. And there's a lot of people that get it. I can tell you thousands of companies that get it. Okay. But it's not a movement, you know, it's not a momentum. I mean, it is. I've analyzed this thing till I'm blue in the face. I think, first of all, there is an emotional thing you got to get over. And that emotional thing is really kind of huge, you know. I mean, do you really care? Are you competitive? You know, do you think you can do it? You know, are you interested at all? I mean, there was a, and that's why the concept of the game came into play, okay? Yeah. Because, you know, universally, people don't like to lose. Okay? They don't like to lose.
Especially entrepreneurs, too, who are very, very ego-driven.
Well, yeah, I don't disagree with that, you know. But I think that the second side of why more people don't do it is then they get into the dirty secret side, okay? That there, a lot of businesses have a lot of dirty secrets inside them, all right? And dirty secrets has a long list, okay? And one of the dirtiest secrets are, we're really doing bad. And nobody, I mean, I get more questions saying, well, if I go out there and tell my people we're doing bad, they'll leave. And I said, well, so you only tell them good stuff? And he goes, oh, yeah, yeah. And I go, so what's their reaction? Goes, so what's their reaction? Oh, they don't believe me. They know something's up, you know?
Well, because I can't pay my vendors on time, or I'm juggling stuff, or like.
Oh God, yeah, and that is another story all to its own, and how that unfolds distrust in an organization. Oh, you know, nobody knows those painful experiences when you're bleeding cash or you're losing cash, or, I mean, when you get down to not being able to pay your suppliers, that's your last line of credit.
Oh my gosh. I tell you what, I've got too many stories for this podcast, and it's quite a few beers. I mean, like to the point where, like, you know, you cut your manager's manual checks because that gives you 3 days afloat. And then it's everything from, you know, forgetting to drop it into the mail and then you take a picture of it and you send it. I mean, it's all that shit that just, like, it's like, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
It's just.
That's exactly right.
Well, and
you go.
What's that?
Well, you go upstream in your income statement, figure out where it's broken, then you fix what's broken, and then it comes back and you get yourself out of the hole, you know?
Oh, I know.
But if you got no income statement to climb in or raise up, you know, then what do you got? You know.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm thinking, Jack. You know, like where I hope some things that, you know, to your point, I hope that there's a movement that's starting, because, you know, the things that I see, first of all, you know, Ray Dalio talks about, like, I mean, we're in a long-term debt cycle that's going to hit, right? There's the
product. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
It's slowing. You look at the balance sheets of all the companies, private, public. I mean, no one has, we're running out of money to fuel this. And so it's a systemic issue. And if you think about what we're talking about, like, look at the balance sheet and income statement of the US and all the companies. I mean, it all rolls up into one, right? And Ray's talking about, you know, like, we have to invest for the long term. But then you layer this, the stuff that the kind of the big data points, and I'm curious in your thoughts on, is if I'm, you know, crazy or like, is we have the boomer cliff, the demographic cliff that's forcing these people to come into reality. Cause like when they go and say, I want to retire. And then you like I said, you reverse engineer and you say, well, you're going to walk away with maybe 800 grand and you don't have enough money to retire. And then they're going, well, now what? And so there's enough, I think, you know, forcing people to deal with the emotional and the dirty secrets because they have no choice. I mean, if they want
out. But it happened. It happened at the dot-com crisis. Okay, I was there at the dot-com crisis, and I saw $1 trillion leave the market in almost a weekend. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to get programmers out of the local college here, and these guys were 23 years old demanding six figures and options. And I go, are you out of your mind? You know, where world are you coming from? Well, a lot of that's no different than what's going on right now. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are all these high expectations, and there's nothing wrong with high expectations, but eventually you crash to reality, you know?
Well, and I agree. But the interesting thing is that was, you know, tied to a lot of public companies where, like, in, you know, thing people race into public, where this is like the backbone of America, which is what, you know, Bo talks about. I mean, this is, you know, the average person with a $5, $10 million company that, you know, have you ever heard of Mike Malkovich? He wrote a book called Profit First.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's coming on the show soon. And he's like, yeah, like same stories where all these people, you know, he's like, all these entrepreneurs, I realize that everybody's in the same boat. Like 95% of these people aren't making any money. And so I just hopefully that there's a way to like shift that. And I think, you know, the conscious capitalism and then like your open book management, like getting people to reach, like getting the owners to say, hey, I need some help. I mean, implementing something like what you're talking about will actually get them to the point where they can get there, because I think their people will care about them and, like, you know, push it, you know, help solve the problem.
Well, I want to go back to your original comment on debt and just say that someone's got to start teaching people debt. Okay. We don't teach people debt. That's why part of our process in the Great Game of Business, okay, is to be able to teach the consequences of debt. And we feel that it's not being taught universally, but yet it's got to be the business community that's going to be teaching the people. Once we teach the people about debt, hopefully the universities will listen to us, okay? And consequently, maybe the government will listen. But I think the idea of debt has got to start at the bottom, and we can't give up on the top, okay? Because I don't think it's going to happen on the top.
Yep.
So what's got to happen is that it's got to start in the bottom, okay? And the bottom's got to move up. And that's why I think business is a vehicle for change. I mean, that's why you and I and Bo, and that's why wonderful people get together with this philosophy, okay? Because it's a very uplifting, you know, it's almost spiritual to a certain degree, that there is hope out there, okay?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. Like, I'm the magic that we had in our business and like the people and like, you, I mean, it's the same thing, like the whole Mihai Kecskemét has got this term flow, right? Like you're literally in the flow, in the zone, which is all the football and, you know, the athletes that, I mean, there is something there that actually happens when you're all playing the same game. You know, one thing, Jack, that I wanted to have you comment on is, you know, a lot of owners might, you know, you have the spot in the book where, you know, a lot of owners have the use of control, the dirty secrets, all this stuff. But then, like, you know, all of a sudden, am I going to be having a bunch of cooks in the kitchen that are telling me what to do? Right? I can't use it. You know, the whole
thing. That doesn't happen.
Well, okay. And can you explain why? Because I think you got the whole, like, you know, there's a bunch of myths of, like, you know, the arguments against equity and, like, how.
Well, because what with. And let me just tell you, with knowledge, with authority, with responsibility, with ownership. That is a heavy burden. Okay. It's a task. And those entrepreneurs that eat that by themselves can't go out of their office unless their tie's perfectly straight or feel that they have to have all the right answers, okay, or say the right things. What a horrible life.
Okay. So you know,
like they're totally petrified every day. They go to YPO because they're looking to find people that are having the same drama that they're having. Okay. I mean, I really think it's a great organization, but I think a lot of it is that, you know, everyone's trying to figure out the gnawing need that they have inside. Let people down. You've got this position of authority, power, and so it's better for you to keep it all in contained. And the reality is that when you delegate all that, you're delegating part of that burden to other people.
Actually, most of it.
So I'm not going to come running in there and picking up more responsibility and burden. All right. Hey, I'll take anyone that wants to come in my office and take, you know, shit off my desk.
Right.
You handle this one, you know, you handle this incredibly idiotic worker comp case. Okay. Because it's going to affect the value of your company, you know?
Oh my God. I love it.
They don't realize that with information comes drama. It comes responsibility. It comes performance. You know, I've been playing this whole idea. We're blowing smoke up people's ass by saying this is value driven. And what freaks me out is I don't think you can have values without performance.
Yeah.
Okay. I think what happens is the lack of performance to the values destroys the whole value over the long period of time.
Yeah. Well, and then like the end, you talk about the invisible enemy, like stuff that is not talked about. People make shit up anyways, and it's usually worse.
Yes. They're instinctive anyways. Okay. You know, they're instinctive. They're pretty damn smart.
Yeah. Most people are. And they're like, yeah, I mean, like, and there's hidden, you know, cues all over the place to kind of get the overall general feeling. Can you explain, Jack, like, you know, not like you were explaining like the meeting, and I think your bonus story tells a lot about how powerful this is, because first of all, on the taking shit off your desk, I mean, you know, there's two things. So the bonus story, but then, you know, I think you start with this, which is, you know, in the meetings, so many people were like the managers or the owner will go in and tell people versus like, you know, when you say you push back and like kind of this whole concept of like, I think it was that meeting where you're in the book where you're saying like someone was asking stuff and you don't want to be the guy with answers because then they're going to always go to you with answers. So like, and then
the idea is that you don't have all the answers. Okay. I mean, look, we got a bonus. Our bonus program comes from the weaknesses in the financial plan. Okay. And so what we do is we call it the critical number. The critical number is what can take you down, can take you out. Okay. And you got to have the guts to face the weakness, right? So we'll do a financial plan and then we'll measure its ratios and then we'll get the worst ratio. All right. So this year, our bonus program is retention. Okay.
Okay.
Because if we do not improve our retention here, okay, by 2020, we will be in trouble. Okay. I mean, come on, let's face the reality is that we got high turnover rates right now. Everybody, I got statistics in every industry, okay? Mm-hmm. But if you don't do something about that right now, all right, if you don't build a culture, if you don't figure out a hook in order to be able to get people, you know, you will not be able to take advantage of a marketplace because the shortages of people are getting worse and worse, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what we will do is we'll put a bounty on it. We'll put a bonus program together. They'll say that, you know, industry averages are like 67% retention. We're running at 7%. We know that if we go from 77% to, let's say, 83%, 83% would be really achievable. You know the number of dollars we would save. In fact, we prove that retention rate. It's in the millions of dollars. We then would have that for a bonus program. But more importantly, we would then fix the weakness that we have inside the company. And then next year, we do the same thing and have another weakness, okay?
Okay.
So the whole idea of an incentive program, okay, is to look at what a banker would look like and say, your inventory turns suck, right? Mm-hmm. So you say, okay, they're right. There's more cash flow in that thing. So if we do get the cash flow, then we'll have some money for a bonus program. Let's give the associates that piece, but more importantly, we will turn inventories much quicker going forward over the years, We fixed that thing. Now let's go see what else is broken. Because everything, something breaks every year, right?
Right. Totally. So, you know, can you maybe, you probably have plenty of stories, but there was that one in the book about like how your employees take responsibility when that bonus pro, because of how diligently they're looking at the numbers and everybody is, because I mean, those are some hard decisions that you had to have made. Well, because you weren't making them, but they
were. Well, let me just tell you, let me tell you this, that you don't know what you have in your organization. You don't know the intelligence that you have in your office or your shop floor. Okay. Unless you challenge that. In my first year of business, I was talking about the weakness. Okay. So it's really easy in your first year when you're 89-1 debt to equity.
There's lots of weaknesses. Have
a yeah, it's a hell of a weakness. So you have a bonus program to improve the weakness, right? And man, I'll tell you one thing, using debt to equity as a your first bonus program is a gift because everybody affects debt to equity, everything they do. Okay. Yeah. So we could roll back all these specific inputs in terms of debt to equity. And so after the first 6 months, man, we are now down to 60-1, okay? Because people got smart real fast, right? And I thought we were the hottest thing in town. I thought, man, we're brilliant, you know? This is, you know, we're maybe we are smart, you know? So I'm down in the shop floor, and, you know, we're using everything. Job security is 89-1, you know, bonus program is 89-1. Health of the company's been tied to the health of the balance sheet. And this janitor was pushing his broom, Dave Skidmore. And he came up to me and he goes, you talk about debt to equity, you talk about job security. He goes, you're full of it. And I go, whoa, what's wrong? He says, I looked at your balance sheet the other day. He goes, 76% of your receivables in the truck market. And the truck market has a recession every 6 years. So it really doesn't matter if we get a healthy balance sheet. He said, you're going to lay us off anyways as soon as the market collapses.
The janitor says that. I love it.
This is a guy's answer that I dropped right there, right? I mean, I'm coming off this high. I'm the smartest guy in town. And he nails me, takes my legs out from under me, right? So I go back, obviously, and tell my people, like a genius, said, you know, the 76% of our so our critical number the next year then becomes diversification. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we then realized that we had to get less emphasis on the truck market and we had to spread our receivables into different markets. And we set the next year up with diversification as the critical number. They were able to get that. And we all did that because the janitor told us about the balance sheet.
Oh my God, that's the greatest story ever.
But there's many stories like that. There are many stories about that. Yeah.
Well, in you know, explain when you, in the book, when you're talking about, because this really shows when you're humming, I think, on all cylinders, is when you guys miss the bonus programs and you kind of helped, you know, facilitate the employees making the decision on what to do. Because that must have been really, really tough.
Oh, no. It's really not tough when you miss the bonus program. Okay. Like right now, here's what's crazy. We're missing the retention bonus program right now. Okay. We're missing it. We didn't even, in the first 6 months, we got like 75% instead of 77, which would have been the first step in the bonus program. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Every single person now understands that they have a responsibility to meet the new associates, pick the right associates, find out the DNA of what somebody is best at a specific job. I mean, we are turning rocks like you wouldn't believe.
Oh, I bet. That's...
Okay. And we're not making the bonus program. Okay. Yeah. But they know right now, this is the God's honest truth. Last year, and we have had record years. Okay. I mean, really record years. But because of retention, we left $10 million on the table last year.
Yeah.
We left $10 million. Yep. Okay. Now, and that means that for every person that you turn over, it's going to cost you $6,500 to $12,000, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So this is education. Okay. Failure is about education if it's proposed in the right area, but why waste the education? Well, if they fix this thing with retention, we will dominate our market in 2021, 2022.
Yep. Yep.
It's easier to come from behind than it is to win with a lead. Okay.
No, well, right. It's my dad always used to say this is, people do their worst work in the good times because, you know, it just covers everything.
Yeah, your dad's right.
Yeah, yeah. And the best time in the worst.
Right.
Like, I learned a lot, man, but like there was not a whole lot of money floating around. But I going back to one of my points, Jack, is like, you know, I think it's easy. It shows, I think it says so much about what you've built, because, and all the people. And when I say you and the people, is like, when you missed your bone, like two quarters in a row by 0.1%, it's super easy.
Yeah.
To be able to just make a call and do something. Yeah. I think that story, I mean, that ripples into like a lot of the DNA of what you guys have created.
Well, they would, if we had rolled over and then 0.1%, they would have been suspect that we had two sets of books.
So can you give that little story? Cause I mean, you didn't even like, it wasn't you just going in and saying, hey, this is what we're doing, because it would have been really easy for your managers to kind of push you over, but like how that process.
Well, you know what, one of the perceptions was that we were, you know, we were growing manufacturing and it was taking a lot of capital. And instead of just continuing manufacturing, we said, well, how do we get into a cash flow business? But that's a different story. But the bottom line was, is let's say that we had to have a return on assets of about 20%, right, in order to get maximum bonus, mm-hmm. or even it could be the minimum bonus. The point of the matter is that they hit 19.8, right? 0.1%. And the dilemma came down to is, so did they not make the bonus program? And the reality is that the transparency of it is that they didn't. Mm-hmm. So if you were going to just feel sorry for them and create an entitlement mentality, you're going to fall victim to that trap if in fact you wrote the check, right?
Yep. Yep.
So we said, no, we didn't make it. We, you know, this is the real world. This is, teaching reality is tough, you know,
it's tough. Right. You don't get a participation award, right? You didn't win.
Exactly right. Yeah, you're damn exactly right.
But what I think was really cool about that is you didn't say yes or no. Like you pushed it back to your managers who went back to the shop. So like it was a.
Everything's done on a consensus basis.
Yeah,
I mean, it is. It's all consensus.
Yep. It's not just going, okay, what is Jack? You know, can we push and manipulate Jack? So
like, no, because they know that I'll take either side of an issue. They'll never know which issue I'm taking sides of. It also makes it a really good leader. You know.
Yep. Jack, this has been honestly one of my favorite. I mean, this has been just so much fun.
Brian, it's good to see you. I hope we get together and have a beer one of these days.
Oh, that doesn't take much convincing on my end. So,
well, me neither.
If there's one thing, you know, we covered a lot, but you know, if for an owner that's looking up and they're going, okay, I'm willing to potentially take on the emotional shit head on and the potential secrets, like, what would be the first step, you know, for someone to say, okay, I'm willing to look up and play the right game? I mean, how do you start? What would be their first, what would be your takeaway for them?
Okay. I'm crazy enough to sit there and say, okay, you know, what are you going, you guys put together the financial plan. All right. I'd have them put the financial plan together. And I think one of the things that would happen is they'd say, well, I don't know how, or they would say, and they would create the most incredible, ridiculous plan. And then you would really get a really smack in the face realizing, holy shit, they don't know. They don't know. Here I am working to get to this particular point. I'm the only one that knows the point. I mean, when I go and talk to a CEO, I say, well, ask them what the sales of the company are. And they'll say, they if they think the sales are $5 million, then you say, well, what is the compensation of the owner? They'll go, well, it's $5 million.
Okay. Yep.
I mean, they truly think, you couldn't believe the responses that we get from people that we perceive that we think they know, and they're off by a factor of a multiple of six.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
Jack, when we, because we were doing 20 million in revenue, you know what people think we sold for? Like, they're like, oh, I bet you the Tansom pulled down like 40 million. I'm like, we did not have an Instagram that we sold, guys. Like, this is ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, I know. We got to get rid of the perceptions, or we got to face the reality that there are perceptions that are screwing our goal to get to it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, if you're letting people out there with shades on doing work, okay, and keeping them in the blind, you can't figure out why you can't move the needle, you might start right there, okay?
It's like putting a bunch of players, you know, just grabbing a bunch of people and going, yeah, okay, let's play the game, and you got – couple baseball players, couple soccer players, couple football players, and no one knowing what the hell they're playing.
Yeah. Yeah. And then if you, there's an analogy, which is pretty interesting about football. And if you use that same analogy in engagement, four of your 11 players on a football team are playing for the other team.
Exactly. Yeah. That does not sound like a team I would like to coach.
Yeah. Right.
Jack, if our listeners can find more information about you and the Great Game and all this stuff, what would be the best place?
Greatgame.com. You know, it's pretty easy. You know, just there's a whole mess of case studies. There's a whole mess of contacts you can get a hold of. Okay, there are people in your areas that you can talk to and go look at and, you know, look under the hood and see if there's an engine there and it's running. And, you know, there's a lot of support groups out there. And you're one of them. And we do appreciate for taking the opportunity to put us on your podcast.
This has been fun, Jack. Thanks so much for coming on.
Ryan, let's see each other soon.
Wow. I don't know how many takeaways you had if you got to the end, but I'll tell you what, that was one of my favorite episodes I've ever done because it's no bullshit. The reality is so many other entrepreneurs are struggling. Everybody's juggling cash flow. Everybody's trying to make ends meet. Why not play the right game? Cut the bullshit and then actually listen to what he's saying. Start talking to other entrepreneurs that get this and you'll start to understand that you're not alone. That's one of the biggest takeaways that I've had over the last 5 years since we sold is that most entrepreneurs are struggling with all of the same things. So emotionally deal with getting everybody on board, realizing that you don't have to have all the answers. If you have secrets that the business is covering up, slowly start to address them and just be vulnerable because people will help. I swear to God, I was in a company where we got everybody helping us trying to accomplish our goal and it's absolutely magical. It's worth it. It's a ton of fun. Everybody can make money. And I just really hope that you had a little bit of an eye-opener and you go start diving into his material, get the book, read The Great Game of Business because it's something that it's worth the time and the effort. So with that being said, I really hope you enjoyed the episode. If you enjoyed it, share it with anybody that you think could use the insight. Give me a rating on iTunes and let me know if you have anybody like Jack or any other great authors or speakers or entrepreneurs that you think would be beneficial for the show. So with that being said, I will see you next week.